years.
Joseph, you wrote the definitive book on the hero with a thousand faces. And do you see that we have any heroes in our culture, in our society?
Well, popular heroes are right now, I think, very, very crude. I don't mean to say that the people who are the heroes are crude, but the order of life they represent is crude.
Maybe sports figures or
this
movie
is exactly,
figures.
Exactly. Or political figures. These are people playing the obvious game. But the deep spiritual masters and heroes are not the public heroes. I find, however, that in private life, people I talk to, they have heroes that are not those that are in the public media. A great hero is Jesus, for example. A great hero is the Buddha. And these figures are operative in lives, not very much in the popular way, but you see what people are reading. They start in the back of the paper, it's sports figures. Those are fine, but they represent only one aspect of life, that is that of physical well-being and competence and attention to the game. Then the intellectual or spiritual heroes, we don't hear so much about them. For me personally, when I was growing up, I had sports heroes, but also the heroes of my intellectual life. James Joyce was one, Thomas Mann another. And I think people have those heroes now as well, private to each. It's a world where we have many, many ways of life. And a single overall philosophy or hero giving is not possible anymore.
Joseph, I want to thank you. It's been an extraordinary and enlightening conversation once again.
Thank you, Michael. Always a real pleasure to be with you.
In this program, Joseph discusses the distinction between knowledge and wisdom, the practical aspects of meditation, the spiritual aspects of relationship, and the teaching function of myth. He also has some very illuminating comments on the breakdown of human decency at the very time we are being called upon to recognize that we are a single world community. He points again to the essential unity of all humankind, and offers the hope that, by rediscovering our mythic traditions and the lessons they provide, we may yet be able to act out of our common humanity. This conversation took place in the spring of 1984, when Joseph was 80 years of age. We began with a question about relationship and meditation.
One of the things I think you said or wrote about, I can't recall which, but it was in an article, I think, an interview with you, where you talked about the importance of relationship, and you talked about it in relative to meditation.
Yeah.
And how the meditation quest could be the death of relationship. What did you mean with that?
Oh, I was noticing, and this was way back, that when my friends would start to go to some meditation interviews with gurus or whatnot, 3 or 4 years later, I'd be hearing about their divorce. And this finding of the divine in yourself, without seeing it in other people as well, is what I think has come out of a good deal of this inward life meditation thing. Why isn't our relationship right here basis for a meditation of our, common humanity? That's what we're talking about, isn't it? And that's what we're always talking about. And so I think for the Western person, where our social traditions don't insist on the relationship system as they do in the East, going then into inward meditation is a distraction from the world. Furthermore, the inward meditation in India, at any rate, belongs to the second half of life, not the first. And here are people who haven't even experienced life yet learning how to get out of it. It's not quite harmonious to our needs.
I recall that student that came up to you in one of your talks and said, "Professor Campbell, what we're doing today is we're going from infancy to wisdom." And you said...
That was a shock to me, really. I have been talking about Dante and the stages of life, you know, moving from adolescence and so forth through the period of maturity, then to wisdom. And this youngster comes up at the end of the lecture and says, Dr. Campbell, you don't realize today we go directly from what you call infancy to wisdom. Well, I said, darling, that's really wonderful. All you've missed is life, you know? Well, that surprised me at that time, but I had three more youngsters during the course of that wonderful period, the 60s, come up with that one.
Joseph, that last anecdote about missing life certainly brings to mind the importance and the relevance of myth and exploring the depth and breadth of mythology to bringing us more in touch with how important it is to live life as fully and completely as possible. Because certainly all the mythic lore that we can come across, at its essence, is that understanding, appreciation, and deep experience of life and all its richness.
Well, there's a good point here, Michael. This young lady thought, as a result of sitting at a desk in school year after year after year, that wisdom consists in knowledge, you know, knowledge obtained from books and from concepts. But it's the integration of this with life that really constitutes wisdom. And myths do not come from a concept system. They come from a life system. They come out of a deeper center. We must not confuse mythology with ideology, you know. Myths come from where the heart is and where the experience is. And the mind may even wonder why people believe these things. The myth is not pointing to a fact. The myth is pointing beyond facts to something that informs the fact. It's, as I've been saying to people who've been interviewing me lately, I've been on a trip for this book doing the publicity, and it has involved a lot of interviews with people who ask, what is a myth? It's amazing. And finally, I found out what's the problem. A myth is a metaphor that points beyond the image to a mystery, and I'll tell you what the mystery is in a minute. When the metaphor is mistaken for the message, for instance, there was one interviewer who, finally I realized, he didn't know what a metaphor is, so he didn't know what I was talking about. And I said, well, give me an example of a metaphor. He was totally broken up. And finally, after fussing around, he comes out with, I'll try. He said, so-and-so runs very fast, and people say he runs like a deer. That's a metaphor. I said, no, that's not a metaphor. The metaphor is so-and-so is a deer. Well, he said, that's a lie, just as myth is. I said, no, it's a metaphor. Well, then when you think God is our Father, you think he is? That's a metaphor. And the metaphor points to two ends. One is psychological. That's why dream is metaphoric. It's metaphoric of the structures in the psyche. And your dream will have to do with the level of psychological realization that you are operating on or that's pushing. And these levels can be deepened. The ultimate depth, however, is the metaphysical, pointing past all conceptualizations, all things and so forth. And so you have a double metaphor here. One is psychological, and the other is metaphysical. And when the two have brought together, where psyche and metaphysics come together, there you have a real myth. And then the whole of your life in the world, the sociological and the cosmological aspects, have to be revisioned in terms of these realizations. That's the function of the artist today. So there are two stages to this thing. One is going inward, finding the relationship to your own deepest ground to the ground of being so that you become, as it were, transparent to transcendence. And the other is then that of bringing this realization back into operation in the field. And that's the work of the artist to interpret the contemporary world as experienced and as known in terms of this relevance to our inward life.
Let me attempt to try a simple translation here. What we're talking about is the myth that we know about, the traditions and the kinds of lore that we'll find in your books are the collective myths. These are the myths that have been collected over humanity's history. And what's important is for each of us to probe our own individual myth in relationship to that collective myth. Is that what you're saying?
Two aspects. One, to probe your own individual myth, and the other, to bring it into relation. You know, that's the function of meditation, and that's the function of poetic and aesthetic insight.
So there's a very practical aspect to myth.
Well, you bet your life.
It's not just meant for the shelves of academe.
On the contrary, I mean, that's where it loses. And when it's reduced to that, all you have then is academic thinking, which I find that the real academic, the specialist academic, doesn't know what it's all about. They don't The only reviews I've had of my book from professional anthropologists have been ridiculous. And the real reviews have come from humanists, from people who know what I'm trying to do.
Well, when we look at our entire educational structure, one notices that it's almost devoid of life experience. It's basically knowledge out of books.
That's correct.
That seems to be a big problem.
Well, that's something that every student really realizes at a certain point. You know, what in heaven's name am I going to do with this stuff? I can remember the day that occurred to me. I was in Paris, graduate school, studying Romance philology and medieval literature, and I was sitting in the Garden of Cluny there, where Bouvard Miche and Saint-Germain come together, and I thought, what in heaven's name am I doing? I don't even know how to eat a decent, nourishing meal, and here I'm learning what happened to vulgar Latin when it passed into Portuguese and Spanish and French. I quit. That was where I really gave up the work on the PhD. And